All right, Eric.
All right, Charles, how are you doing?
Good, man. So we're in Building 99, MSR. Yep. Yep. Another episode of EDE.
Exactly.
What's going on?
Well, we're talking with Butler Lampson here. This is one of the nesters of computer science.
Yep.
So I'm really excited, to kind of have a chance to talk to him. And I think
all the white hair.
Yeah. Well, you have more hair than me, which is kind of bad. But hey.
So Eric, for the people in the audience who might not know immediately who Butler is, what do you mean, Master of Science of Computer
the
Science?
The Nestor of Computer Science. Yes. Well, if you just go to his webpage, you can see. I don't know where the first. I think your first paper on your website is like about interactive machine language programming. And so that's kind of, an interesting concept, because I think that was kind of further ahead than many IDEs today, where, you're still kind of in the edit debug cycle, so it's less interactive than what Butler kind of proposed like many, many years ago. So so that was also kind of the lead into my first question. So a lot of, there's this kind of saying, right, those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. And since you've been around in the industry for a long time, you must have that feeling often, I would guess, that, we seem to be kind of reinventing things over and over again.
Well, that's definitely true. We not only reinvent things over and over again in time, but also every subfield likes to reinvent things rather than looking to see what was done in some other field that might be relevant.
So so can you give, your experience, what is the kind of main thing that we kind of, that the young guys like us, not remembered or kind of,
Well, there's lots of examples. Ivan Sutherland years ago proposed his version of this, which he called the Wheel of Reincarnation, where the idea was he originally conceived of it in the context of graphics accelerators, where he said, in the earliest days of graphics, the computer would execute an instruction to paint to get the XY coordinates for each dot. And of course, if you want a lot of dots, that takes a long time. Yeah. So people said, gosh, maybe we should make it possible for the computer to, say, draw a line from here to here, and then there would be special hardware that would generate all the necessary dots. And that was okay, but then, lines, not complicated enough. You've got to have circles and fill things in and have characters and so forth. And pretty soon you have a whole sort of subcomputer. And now it seems awfully wasteful to have that subcomputer drawing each individual dot. So now you kind of go another turn of the wheel. An interesting recent example, I think, is the browser, which people are now beginning to understand is actually an operating system.
Yep. Hmm. We had an interview with the Gazelle folks, right?
Yes, we did.
A couple of weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And all the issues having to do with resource allocation and security and naming and all those other things that have been laboriously worked out in operating systems over the last 40 years are in the process of being reinvented by the browser people.
Yeah, so that's kind of an interesting thing. What I often observe, and I don't know why that is that we seem to be reinventing the layer kind of below and just kind of re-implementing that, because in the end, it's just TCP/IP where you send bytes across, but now we're kind of repeating those layers at a higher level of abstraction. Why is that necessary, or is that not necessary?
Why is it necessary to reinvent naming?
Or why does that happen? Yes, or why can't we just kind of drill down and kind of just use the underlying mechanism?
Well, you wouldn't want to do that. If you're writing a browser app, what good is TCP?
Well, because, why would you kind of, layer exactly the same kind of protocols kind of, again and again on top of that, instead of, sending around bytes, you send around XML. And yes. What did you gain with that?
By sending XML rather than bytes?
Yeah.
It has a lot more semantics than bytes do.
But, does the protocol need to understand the semantics of the XML? I mean, does HTTP, does it understand, what's in the payload?
Absolutely. HTTP understands brackets P bracket. It's a paragraph break.
Well, but that's the browser, right? It's not the kind of, the network stack. Yes, of course, the browser, but,
Oh, but the HTTP protocol is actually a fairly thin layer on top of TCP, right? It uses TCP. It does a good job. It uses TCP for the transport, and what it basically adds is its own naming system, which TCP lacks.
Okay, so you, so
plus it has a few error handling things, but it doesn't really have that much.
Yeah, so I get the impression that we often kind of, you know, you're trying to send, you know, one, you know, value from here to here, and then we're kind of, you know, converting it, sending it as bytes, and then kind of, you know, so there seems to be a kind of a lot of, you know, work in the different layers. It's like, you know, archaeology, where you can, you know, dig down to the lower layer, and there it's like where the real thing happens, and then it kind of on the other side you kind of stack it up again.
That happens. But if you're sitting way up there in the form on top of the browser and you want to send a byte to the server, getting your hands on a raw TCP connection and stuffing the integer down that connection is not very attractive.
Well, I'm not so sure.
I think that would be good.
Yeah, I think that would be
good. Have you tried it?
Well, have you?
I kind of doubt
that. Okay, well, maybe, I don't know. It's, but so that's interesting. So another thing is like, you know...
Sometimes I agree with you, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, my friend Ed Satterthwaite years ago was building some sort of network gadget. I think it was an ISDN to Ethernet bridge. And he bought some manufacturer's ISDN chip, and it came with a sizable pile of software written in C, which compiled into about 100 kilobytes of 68,000 code. And Ed had a feeling that, just as you say, the software wasn't actually doing enough to justify the 100 kilobytes. So he started to, and the documentation explained how it implemented the ISO 7-layer model for communication and all that sort of thing. So Ed started to peel away the layers, and he peeled and he peeled and he peeled and he peeled. And when he was finished, he was exactly in the state that you said, that wasn't actually doing anything.
Yes.
Except rebuilding the same machinery in the different layers language as it worked its way up.
Yeah.
So that was a good example of what you said. Yeah. But I don't think, if you think about typing the number into the form field, I don't think that's such a good example.
Okay.
It wouldn't be so appealing to go down and try to do that with raw TCP.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's kind of, you know, my kind of, you know, I like kind of, you know, just the kind of raw, simple things.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, simple is in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah, it is, sir.
Is a web search simple or complex?
Yeah.
Good question. It's certainly complex on the server.
What do you think?
Well, you know, again, it depends, right? For me as the user, end user, it's easy. But, you know, as we kind of, you know, we spoke with the big guys, like, you know, like recently there, it's like
a lot of machinery.
Yep.
Or even, you know, you're telling me that it would be so simple to just send the integer over TCP, but, you know, TCP is running on top of the internet, which is pretty complicated. You know, why should we do that? Why don't we just make a phone call? Send the thing over a modem. That would be a lot simpler than TCP.
Yeah, well, but you know, sometimes it's even faster to just send a truck, right? With, you know, the disk. So
if there's a lot of it, that's right. And the whole thing is running on top of your Pentium microprocessor. And inside there is all kinds of horrendous complexity.
Yeah.
And so on, all the way down until you get to quantum electrodynamics.
Yeah, but I don't know. It's like this. I sometimes, like at night, you think, you know, because we have like so many layers, like what you say, but like there's the hardware, well, that's internally probably uses microcode and some virtualization, and then there's a virtual machine, and then you run the kind of .NET VM. And so there's so many layers of interpretation.
But those things have value.
And let's hope so. And sometimes I'm not so sure, kind of, you know, what the kind of real value is. But
well, typically there's a good reason for each one of those layers.
So
here's an interesting example. This is a little bit obsolete today, but just a few years ago, most people connected their machines to the internet. The last mile was done with a modem.
Yep.
So think about how the modem works. It's trying to transmit 56 kilobits per second of digital data over a voice grade line.
Yep.
But if you look at what's actually going on, what happens to the voice grade line as soon as you get to the central office is that it gets redigitized. And now the entire internals of the phone system is carrying the what somebody thought was the voice call as 56 kilobits. Bits per second of digital data. So what was the advantage of going from digital to analog and then back to digital? Why did we do that? You would say that was a terrible, stupid thing.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is that there's several hundred million voice grade lines installed.
Yeah.
And if you do this, you get to use them without having to mess with them.
Yeah, sure.
Whereas if you want to get your hands directly on the digital circuit, people did that too, right? It was called ISDN. That was a disaster. It was a complete disaster.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sorry. I think it's a good question.
Even though it was much closer to your ideal story.
So to kind of continue in this kind of, you know, the networking thing. So one of the things that you, I think you invented was RPC.
I had something to do with it.
Yeah. So now, so RPC, but now a lot of people are saying, you know, RPC, you know, that kind of, you know, abstracts too much from kind of, you know, the fact that you're making a call across the network.
Yeah, I say that too.
So, but did you say that when you wrote the original paper?
No, or it seemed like a great idea. It just didn't work out that well.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that the net contribution of RPC to human welfare has been negative.
Yeah.
But we thought it was going to be great.
Yes. So
actually, RPC was invented by the people who were building the so-called National Software Works, which was an ARPA project of the mid-70s to try to get a whole bunch of computers hooked up and build what I suppose today we would think of as a distributed IDE.
Mm-hmm.
That project was a complete disaster, but that was where RPC got invented.
Interesting. Yeah. So, but one of the things, right, that kind of, you know, we have to deal with when we're talking about distributed systems is, like, you know, the latency and asynchronousy. So, do you have any kind of ideas of how we can, you know, because a lot, you did programming language design too, right? So, how, you know, it seems that current programming languages are not suited to kind of, you know, do asynchronous programming. It's all, that's, I think, also why RPC was invented, right? Oh, let's make it look like a normal procedure call because that's what we have. So, but what do we need to make that easy?
Well, that part I actually think is kind of okay. You know, a lot of people have said, well, we have a lot of problems with RPC, and if we just used asynchronous messages instead, everything would be much better. I don't believe that, because the problem with asynchronous messaging is it says every time you want to communicate, you also have to have concurrency.
Yep.
Well, concurrency is bad. Sometimes it's unavoidable. It definitely makes it harder to write your program.
I agree.
So the idea that every time you want to communicate, you're forced to have concurrency, this can't be good.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Also, in the context in which RPC was originally sort of elaborated in Xerox PARC, threads were very cheap.
Mm-hmm.
So our story was, if you wanted concurrency, make a thread.
Yeah.
And if you don't want concurrency, and then do the RPC call in the thread. If you don't want concurrency, just do the RPC call.
Okay, yeah.
Nowadays, of course, in modern systems, people think of threads as being a lot more expensive, so they're much more reluctant to adopt that strategy.
Which is also kind of strange, right? That kind of in the older days, you would think that, you know, threads would be more expensive because the machines were kind of, you know, more...
Well, we cheated because our threads had a lot of microcode support.
But you would kind of expect also that, you know, when the...
Yeah, why didn't Intel put microcode, kind of support into the x86? Yeah. I can't answer that question.
Yeah. So are you saying that that RPC kind of, you know, from a user perspective is nice, but if you don't want to block, you kind of spin up a kind of cheap thread to make sure that it doesn't block would that be your ideal programming model? Or?
Well, I think the real problems with RPC are not the presence or absence of concurrency. The real problems with RPC have to do with the fact that it encourages you to think that latency is not an issue.
Yes.
And it encourages you to think that failure is not an issue. And it encourages you to think that large things can be passed cheaply.
Yep.
None of which is true.
Yes, exactly.
So if you use it in a very disciplined and controlled way, you'll be fine. But it's very easy to be led down the garden path. Those I think are the real problems.
Okay, but now suppose, you know, that I want to kind of, you know, say latency. Right, so how should I program kind of, you know, to kind of counteract the latency?
Batch,
okay. But programming languages don't have support for that, right? So now
that's a problem.
Yeah.
That's why Link is good, right?
Yep. So
because it does have support for that.
Yeah. So then you can, you know, you can grab the expression trees and, you know, compose them and send them across.
Absolutely.
As kind of, you know, a big unit of work.
That's a huge win.
Yeah. And then the other thing, you know,
there are other strategies you can adopt that are more primitive. Yeah. This is why the reader-writer abstraction is a good one, right? Because it allows you to write the program in terms of grabbing the input one little bit at a time, but it allows the implementation to batch the actual transfer.
Yes. Yeah. And so that's kind of, you know, we comes down also to kind of the push model, right? Where the kind of, in our, the kind of producer can push, and when you want to read it, you're going to...
And you have buffering. But it's, it's successful because it's another way of packaging up batching.
Yeah. Yeah. But you talked also about, like, you know, sending across big kind of, you know, pieces of data. But there is also like a little bit of tension, right? Because, you know, yeah, that's expensive, but if you don't do by value, now you have kind of problems with side effects, and how do you keep state around? So what would you kind of, you know...
Well, you know, all those things that I enumerated, those are real problems that you're going to have if you try to build a distributed system. The trouble with RPC is that it encourages you to ignore those problems.
Yeah. Yes. I agree, but
you know, failure is the same thing.
Yes.
Failure is real.
Yeah.
So if you write your program on the assumption that there's not going to be any failures, and then afterwards you go back and say, oh shit, there's going to be exceptions here and here and here, and I'm going to kind of patch and glue, it's pretty unlikely you're going to get a satisfactory result.
Yeah. Well, I should say that even in normal kind of sequential programming, dealing with failure is kind of, you know, not very convenient, right? With exceptions, it's like, you know, you have your normal control flow, but when an exception happens, now you're kind of suddenly kind of, you know, way out of there, and, you know, there's no way to kind of, you know, resume often, or, you know, to deal with the exception, because where you handle it is far away in time and space from where the exception actually, the error happened.
Well, I consider that to be a feature, actually.
Really?
Because there was a big fad in the 80s for exception systems that did allow you to resume, and that was turned out to be really terrible.
Okay, good. So here's another thing where, you know, nice. I'm trying to reinvent the wrong wheel,
I think the right semantics for exceptions, which is more or less what we have today, except people don't like it, it was invented by Barbara Liskov in the mid-70s when she designed Clue. She said, look, if there's an exception, you have to stop. You have to discard a bunch of work because the meaning of the exception is that some important assumption got violated.
Yes.
So you have to discard a bunch of work, reset to some state that you understand, and then continue.
Okay, but
the idea that you're going to somehow, oh my God, patch things up and resume, it's very unlikely to work.
Okay, but I think this was kind of exactly what I was trying to approach, right? Because right now, say in a modern object or language, if an exception happens, you know, now you're an exception handler, there's no way to see what kind of state you have to kind of, you know, undo and roll back such that you can handle the exception.
Well, that's the object's job, is to take care of that.
But not all objects are kind of, you know, written to, you know...
Well, that's true, but that's a flaw in their design. So how can we fix that? We know one mechanism for fixing that, right? It's called transactions.
Exactly, that was kind of, you know, where I was going to. So, which is another thing that you worked on.
And this is why transactions are cool.
Yes. So, and kind of what I was trying to say is that, yes, the way my ideal way to deal with, you know, exceptions would be that, you know, it's that you can do a transaction, and when the exception happens, you can roll back and then kind of, you know, go on from there.
And my view is, if you are not programming inside a transaction system, it's still your obligation to produce that effect.
Yes.
It's an obligation that's usually shirked, but the result of that is programs that aren't very robust.
Yes. But
effective, I think if you look inside an operating system kernel, for instance, you find that a lot of the code that's in there is precisely devoted to doing this.
Yeah.
Because in the kernel, when there's an exception, you really have to take seriously your responsibility to clean things up and put them in an intelligible state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is why we blue screen.
Yeah. But if you look at a lot of class libraries, they are not kind of, you know, not kind of designed for kind of your rollback or compensating actions.
Well, they're written by slobs.
Yeah.
I mean, what can I say?
Yeah.
So slobs need transactions? Maybe so.
Yeah. So what do you think about transactional memory or STM, or do you think
I think transactional memory is a very interesting idea, but we have absolutely and the reason people are so interested in it is they think it's going to make it much easier to write concurrent programs so that we can exploit multicore.
Mm-hmm.
We have absolutely no idea whether that's true. There's no evidence one way or the other, as far as I know. No one has ever written a program of any significant size from scratch using TM.
So you think the kind of, you know, the Haskell samples that, you know, are kind of toys?
Yeah,
toys.
They're toys.
They're beautiful, but
yes, they're for small things.
Yes.
You know, no hardware manufacturer is going to be motivated to put in TM just so that your 100-line thing can be more beautiful.
Yeah.
It's not worth it. That's not the motivation.
Yeah.
But you mentioned that, like, in the operating system kernel, people have to do this kind of things by hand.
Yeah.
So would you...
Maybe it would make it much easier to write a kernel. We don't know. No one's ever tried it.
So
the closest we've ever come to that is there were some people at I think UT Austin, 2 or 3 years ago, who did the following. They took a Linux kernel, and they went through and they replaced every critical section with a transaction. And they discovered that this did not make things any worse.
Okay.
So that's certainly better than discovering that it makes things really awful.
Yes.
But it doesn't answer any questions about whether it's easier to write the system using transactions.
Yes.
We don't know. No one's ever tried it.
Yeah.
So why do you suppose that is? That no one's ever tried it.
I don't know. Maybe it's too much work, or hard to find funding, or you know. It's like...
I believe the fundamental answer is the ratio of work to papers produced is very unfavorable.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, this is the information we need.
Yeah,
and we're not getting it.
So Simon PJ should write an operating system kernel. And
there we go.
Yes,
all right. Wait a minute. Though. All he would have to do, according to the earlier part of this conversation, is write a web browser. That's an operating system. It also has an operating system kernel. If you're going to go down that route, so hey, Simon, write one in Haskell.
That would be an alternative.
Yeah.
But I was sort of kidding.
Yeah, but that would be a different browser than that would be more like the Gazelle browser, right? Where you have all the kind of all the operating system kind of concepts. But I agree with you. That is kind of
So this would be a good project for you.
Yeah.
Now that you're finished with Link.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah.
Right on, Eric.
I have to convince my manager to kind of do that. But yeah, that would be an interesting.
What are some of the challenges with writing a general purpose operating system that has a transactional kernel?
We don't know. It's never been tried.
But I mean, beyond the fact that it's just a super hard problem, I guess the question would be, what is so hard about the problem?
Well, the hope is, what's so hard about writing an operating system?
No. It's one thing that it's really hard and nobody's done it. The other thing would be, what is it that makes it so hard that nobody wants to do it?
Well, writing an operating system or any other sizable concurrent program is a lot of work.
Yeah. Certainly.
There's nothing particularly... The hope is that if you wrote it with transactions, it would be easier.
Sure. But you could write an operating system that doesn't do very much.
Then it wouldn't be a test of the concept.
Exactly. So, and I think that's exactly, it's like a bootstrapping problem, right? Because and look at either Windows or Linux or whatever other operating system, the amount of man-years that's in there and to make it kind of support everything. And
to answer the question about whether transactions are good for something, you wouldn't have to reproduce Windows or Linux.
Yes.
But you'd have to write something non-trivial.
Yes.
Hmm. Otherwise, you haven't answered the question, which is, does TM help you with writing something non-trivial?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to kind of continue a little bit on the transactions and then with distributed systems, a lot of people now say, but now in the world of the cloud and distributed computation, transactions on that scale don't work.
That's absolutely right. They don't.
And so what should we do instead there? That instead of transactions, what is the kind of the solution there to make that kind of work?
Live with it. That's what people
live with it.
Compensation is the answer.
Yeah. Interesting. And things like eventual consistency.
And eventual consistency is cool. Yeah. Eventual consistency means that the application has to live with it.
Yeah.
Because it has to put up with the inconsistencies, the temporary inconsistencies.
Yeah. So kind of one of the kind of, I think my favorite paper that your talk you gave is about laziness, right? Uh-huh. And of course, as a Haskell guy, that's kind of laziness is kind of built in. But the nice thing about that talk is that it kind of really gives like many, many, many more examples of where laziness kind of is used that go way beyond lazy evaluation of kind of expressions.
Right. That was quite a surprise to me when I started looking into it, how many of those examples there are.
Yes. So can you kind of, give the Niners some of these examples?
Which ones can I think of?
I think one was like with text editors, like for redrawing, when you don't have to redraw the whole kind of or like reformat the whole text because that might not the whole text might be displayed.
Oh right,
that was
right.
One of the examples.
Right, the notion that you've got this whole document.
Yeah.
And in principle, you need to know how to display all of it.
Yeah.
But in actual fact, you're only going to display the portion of it that's currently visible on the screen. So you're going to design your algorithm and your data structures and so forth so that it does the display computation lazily, driven by where the user has scrolled to.
Yeah. So that's kind of, you know, an interesting thing that I find is that often, like, you know, if you're using Haskell, you don't think about the laziness, right? Because, you know, you kind of get it for free.
Yeah.
And then in other situations, you really have to design for it. And what is kind of not clear to me is that, you know, whether when you build laziness in, whether you get the other one for free or whether it kind of might not fit, right? Say we would write Word in Haskell. Would those kind of lazy algorithms for, you know, formatting fall out, or would you still have to kind of, you know, design your data structures?
Well, that you could probably find out in a week or two of work, because the guts of that is not that complex.
Yeah.
So you could just try coding it up and see what happens.
Yes, I'm kind of. You know,
that's easy.
Homework after homework.
No. That's an easy one.
Yeah. That was an easy.
The TM-based operating system. That was a hard one. Okay. This one is easy.
Yeah. So you see, now my kind of job is to kind of write Office in Haskell and Windows in Haskell, right?
Absolutely.
Easy.
Totally.
Yeah. Another thing that, you know, that you've done a lot of work on is security.
That's true.
And
alas.
why
security, this is one of the great failures of computer systems research and engineering over the last 40 years. A lot of work has been done on security. It's been a complete bust as far as I can tell.
And why specifically?
Fundamentally, I think it's because I found this quote on the internet a couple months ago. Some general in the 1950s said, "You can certainly have inconvenience without security, but you cannot have security without inconvenience."
Yep. Mm.
And people don't want inconvenience, therefore they don't want security. And they're only going to put up with security if they absolutely have to. And in spite of the fact that there's a lot of bitching and moaning about the insecurity of the internet, the truth of the matter is that it's not that big a problem.
Yeah.
And therefore, people are not willing to pay anything significant, either in dollars or in inconvenience, to get better security. So it's okay. I don't worry about it too much.
Yeah. I agree with you, but on the other hand, it kind of worries me a little bit, because, you know, as opposed to kind of, you know, and we talked with, like, when Sriram was there, we talked a little bit about this. Like, in the real world, you know, you can live, you know, you don't have to be 100% secure. You can, you know, you can put a certain threshold, and, you know, there's kind of, you know, it's not scalable, right? But in the digital world, you know, if you're not completely secure, now, you know, the bad guys can kind of, you know, use programs to kind of, you know, do the attack. So it's much harder to kind of, you know, have, like, be half secure.
Well,
But you say even that, you know,
it's easy enough to be half secure if you don't, if you update your machine with the latest patches and you don't open random attachments that people send you, you'll be half secure.
Yes.
So how is that different from putting a not very good lock on the front door of your house, which is what almost everyone does?
Yeah.
I don't see the difference.
Okay. So, but now, you know, but that kind of requires that the patches kind of, you know, come in kind of quick enough before the bad guys can
generally
damage.
Generally, it works out okay. I mean, Microsoft has spent a lot of money on this aspect of what we call trustworthy computing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we achieved the desired goal. Right. The desired goal was don't be on the front page of the Times for a security breach. And that happened all the time 5 years ago, and it doesn't happen anymore. Right? Nowadays, if there's going to be a front page Times article about a security breach, it's going to be the VA that gets blamed, not us. Right? Because they had some clown who lost a laptop with 20 million social security numbers on it.
Mm. Yeah.
That's not our problem.
True.
Yeah.
And so it's been a huge success.
But
and that's the only aspect of security that we ever actually cared about.
But what about the engineering aspect, right? I mean, the fundamental problem in some sense is with native code and the ease of...
No.
No.
I don't believe that.
You disagree.
I'll tell you my galactic story.
Tell me your galactic story. Tell us.
The security geek story is make the system perfect so that there are no bugs, and then it'll be secure. This is just not practical, I'm sorry. In real life, people don't care enough about security to be paid the many prices you would have to pay to make the system that well built. So the pragmatic facts are there's going to be bugs. So how can I be secure in spite of that? The answer is the bugs have to be triggered by input. If the system is just sitting there, not connected to the world, not receiving any inputs, then there may be there's going to be bugs, but it's not going to cause me any problems.
Yeah. Sure.
So the way to get security is to restrict the sources of input to your system.
Okay.
So, you know, I should only accept, if I want to be secure, I should only accept email from people that I trust. I should only go to websites that I think are trustworthy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So what's the problem with this? I see two problems with this approach, which I call accountability. I should only accept inputs from sufficiently accountable places. So what is sufficiently accountable? Well, that depends on my own judgment. Right? People that are very conservative, maybe they'll only go to their banks and the government's websites. People that live more wild and free, they'll go to lots of different places. The problem we have today is there's no reasonable way for me to express my idea about how accountable the sources of input should be. So, in my view, one thing we need, if we actually want to have better security, practical better security on the net, is we need some kind of accountability system that makes it possible for me to say to my computer, I don't want you to take any inputs except from places that are at least this accountable. And, you know, this accountable might mean anything from I think I could successfully sue them if they wreck up my machine, to here's my favorite example. How much accountability is enough to get rid of spam? Okay, well, here's one example of what would be enough accountability to get rid of spam. My email client, when it receives an email, it looks at it, and there's if it comes from somebody that I'm already in communication with, then it passes it through. Otherwise, it looks to see whether or not it contains a link signed by some credible source like Hotmail or Google, which has a property that if I click on that link, the sender of the email contributes a dollar to the Salvation Army.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't have such a link, then it goes in the junk pile. That will get rid of spam. Right? Any legitimate guy can put that link in, and he can do it fairly fearlessly, because most of the time, if I think he's legitimate, I'm not going to click on the link, because that's a hostile act. Right?
So
if he's not legitimate, I'll click on the link with enthusiasm, and then it will cost him a lot of money, and he can't afford that.
But I heard this argument before, but the funny thing is that if you look at the kind of real mail, the paper mail, even though that costs money to send,
yes,
I still get
a fair amount of paper. Not nearly as much as you
nearly,
get.
Not nearly as much, but still.
Right. Yeah.
So maybe we should make it $5.
Well, I get to choose.
Yes, you get. Oh, that's interesting. So
I have to be able to choose. That's a vital part. Yes. You have to make a global rule.
Yes.
It.
Oh, okay. Yes.
Okay. So the other thing that's wrong with my story is that, having now decided that I'm only going to accept inputs from accountable people, I can't browse to porn sites anymore, because they're certainly not going to be accountable.
Yeah.
So that's not satisfactory. I need to be able to browse to porn sites. So how can, and, you know, analogous things. So how can we fix that?
Yeah.
Well, the obvious answer is I need two machines. One machine is going to only accept accountable input, and I'm going to keep my taxes and my bank accounts there.
Yeah.
The other machine is going to live wild and free, and not make any demands on accountability. And if anything goes wrong with the second machine, I'm going to push the reset button.
Yep.
So I call that green machine and red machine.
And the funny thing is that's kind of what I already implement.
You have two machines?
I have two machines.
Oh, cool.
And I do it also like with a virtual PC.
Yeah, of course, these wouldn't be physical machines.
Exactly.
These would be two VMs.
Yes, and there's one that I kind of use for, you know, and the other one is where, you know, I know that I can kind of, you know, junk it like every second. Yeah.
Right.
That's interesting.
But how is that different than, say, in Windows 7 and Windows Vista, the idea of user modes, right? So standard, if I surf porn, let's see, stay with your example, a standard user.
Here's the difference.
Okay.
The isolation between the VMs is extremely good.
Yes.
The isolation that Windows is able to impose on a browser session is unfortunately not nearly as good, because it's so much more complex. So that helps, don't get me wrong, but there's very little doubt that the ingenious bad guy will be able to find a flaw in the isolation that Windows is able to impose on the browser. Mm. Yeah. Because the interface is just too complicated.
Yeah. Or you have, like, you know, at home, I actually have, like, you know, a separate physical machine, right? And that's kind of, you know, there it can do everything, and there, you know, we just kind of reinstall whenever something goes wrong.
What if a hacker gets onto that machine and builds a little, you know, really smart thing that sniffs your network, gets onto your other machine? I mean, no, basically...
Your green machine isn't going to talk to your red machine.
Yeah, check it won't.
No, because it's only going to accept inputs from accountable places, and your red machine is
definitely not an accountable place.
So make sure you set that in your settings, man.
Yes. Well, that's quite important. Yes. Yes, that's an important point that I usually leave out. The green machine has to have professional management. Mm.
Yeah.
Because you're not smart enough to manage it properly. You can set the knob about accountability, but it has to have professional management so that settings like that will be done correctly.
Interesting.
So I think this sounds like a very pragmatic solution.
Yeah, well, I've been peddling this story within Microsoft for about 6 years now. I've gotten hardly any traction.
Well, but, you know,
so this is my latest attempt to get traction.
But let me ask this question. Yeah. I mean, because in some sense, if the thing that would concern, of course, Microsoft about it and other people in sort of the fit client camp, right, in between fat client and thin client, is that what you're talking about could certainly just be a thin client. And the operating system is running on.
That's completely separate.
Yes.
If your experience with your computer was just a browser, and you had a very lightweight operating system that was just able to interact with hardware, then there would be no local data store, there would be no local private information, and no executable could run on the system except for your browser and the plugins inside of your browser and stuff like that.
Yes.
So wouldn't that be more secure? In a sense, your data is managed in the cloud and your experience is managed.
It would be somewhat more secure, but there'd still be lots of ways to screw up your data in the cloud. But there's a more fundamental problem with this thin client concept, in my opinion.
Agreed.
Which is, the system's just not reliable. The overall system is just not reliable enough to make that acceptable. The only organizations I know of that can run a computing system that depends on central server for essentially everything are organizations that learned how to do it in the days of mainframes and 3270 terminals. It's actually very hard. For example, Microsoft can't do it. If my machine had the property that every time I'm unable to get to some fundamental service like, say, Exchange, I couldn't do any work at all, that would be completely unacceptable.
Yeah.
Because there's a significant number of minutes during most days when I can't get to Exchange. Not to mention the fact that I can't get to it when I'm on the plane. So it's just too hard. The whole thin client concept, in my opinion, is just brain dead. Because people just don't understand how difficult it is to get an acceptable level of reliability.
Yes, or like offline experience.
So offline experience is essential.
Yeah.
Absolutely essential.
And also, I mean, I think, you know, if you take Butler's kind of, you know, concept, right, the fact where it's thin or rich client is independent of that, right? It's really about, like, you know, isolation and kind of, you know, like, you know, you only kind of talk to things that you trust, yes, and you isolate yourself from the bad things. So it's kind of funny that I already do this intuitively.
Yeah.
So that's a...
Interesting.
So one thing that you said that was interesting, also if I look at one of your older papers, I think it was in 1975, where you kind of predicted that, you know, in 10 years people would be able to prove their programs correct, you know, where the proof would be at most twice as big.
Did I say that?
Yes, you
did. Oh my God. Which paper was that? I'm going to go back and take it off my website.
Yes, yes. Like an editorial for some special issue for something. I think
software practice and experience editorial?
Yes, I think so.
I say that in that editorial?
Yes, you did. Yeah.
Oh, so I said much more sensible things than that editorial,
but
which are the ones I like to remember.
So that was like a prediction kind of in the same kind of, you know, league as, like, we only need one computer. But, you know, here at MSR, I mean, they've been kind of
quite a lot of progress.
Progress and also, like, you know, termination, proof of termination, and things like that. So there's, in some sense, there's quite some progress there.
But it's still a long way from complete correctness proofs.
Yes.
Randy Bryant has a good slogan here. He's one of the pioneers of model checking. He says, I prove small theorems about big programs.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe you can show that the program has no array references out of bounds. That's a small theorem.
Yeah. Mm.
But if you can show that for all of IE, that's good.
Yeah. But again, to go back to your kind of, you know, security idea, maybe, you know, we could prove, formally prove or mechanically prove that, you know, that there's no other ways that this program can get input than via, you know, certain sources, that would be kind of, you know, a useful thing to know, because right now I think it's also, like, if I look at my computer, it's really kind of quite hard to figure out where, you know, it reads information from. So in order to kind of make, to isolate it, I don't know. So if I could have a proof or something where the computer could help me to determine, you know, what are the inputs, and that, or better, you know, that it doesn't kind of read from any other inputs than the ones I know about, well, that would be useful or not.
That would be great. I don't think that there's much hope that you could say, I'm going to take the 50 million lines of code that's running on my PC and I'm going to do a mechanical proof that none of it takes any inputs from any place that I haven't authorized. I see no hope for that. On the other hand, it does seem quite conceivable to me that you could enumerate all the possible sources of input from the rest of the world and then dynamically check that the rule is being followed. That wouldn't be using proof, but it would do the job just as well.
Yeah. So there you had an interesting point. So some people kind of, you know, there's the kind of, you know, the endless debate between static and dynamic typing and so on. So one of the kind of, you know, schools says that, you know, we should not do all this kind of, you know, static checks. We should do everything at runtime, because that's also what the operating system does, right? You know, in the end, you know, everything is checked dynamically. So what is your opinion about that?
I think the answer to the question, like most questions of that kind, the answer to the question, should we do static checking or dynamic checking, has to be yes.
Yes, so you do both.
Yeah. The idea that you're going to do all static checking, I think, is not practical. On the other hand, in Jim Morris's immortal words, there's no debugger in Peoria. So static checking is good because you catch the bug before you get to Peoria.
Yep. So it's like, you know, static where possible, dynamic where necessary.
Where necessary, absolutely.
Yes. Yeah, so that's...
And the definition of necessary, of course, can vary quite a bit depending on what the situation is.
And so, you know, we talked a lot about the kind of the past, right? So, but what are you kind of working on these days? You know, what is brewing kind of, you know, in your brain?
In my own personal work, what's brewing? What do I think is brewing in computing at large?
Both. It's like, you know, I think that's also an interesting thing. Is what do you see? Yes, that's kind of happening in the field at large.
Well, personally, I've been working recently on data synchronization in support of my new doctrine for user interfaces, which is that if your program interacts directly with the user, it should only operate on local data, because the local data is the only data that's going to have predictable access characteristics. Mm-hmm. And the most infuriating thing in a user interface is to have unpredictable pauses.
Yeah.
But that means that essentially all interaction with the rest of the world has to be mediated by some form of data synchronization. But for the what lies before us more broadly, I have this sort of satellite's eye view of computing, which says that computers started out being used for simulation. And that was pretty much what people did for the first 30 years, whether they were simulating payrolls or simulating nuclear weapons. The basic idea was the same. And that was extremely successful and continues to be very successful. And then around 1980, people started to use computers for communication. And that's also been enormously successful, and it's brought us email and the web and you know, the worldwide telescope and Twitter and all kinds of great things. Mm-hmm. And that's also continues to be enormously successful. But it's been another 30 years, and excuse me.
Talking about communication.
Exactly. Very interesting. Excuse me, they pull out my little portable computer. My friend's on.
It's time for a new wave, and the word I use to describe it is embodiment. And what embodiment means is non-trivial interactions with the physical world. The most obvious example is robotics. Mm. And so you guys probably know about the ARPA, autonomous vehicle challenges that they've been running. But there are plenty of other examples. My favorite one that I thought up about 6 months ago, I have a terrible memory for people's names and faces, and I would like to have a little gadget that could be built into my glasses, or it could come in the form of a little tiny camera and a headset, so that when I walk up to you, if I don't right away say, "Hi, Eric," it whispers in my ear, "That's Eric Meyer."
Yeah. Persistent memory.
Yes.
And you last met him.
Yes.
And that's another example of a non-trivial interaction with the physical world. And I think that there are going to be lots of interesting things that continue to be done with computers and simulation and with computers and communication. But I think that this whole area of embodiment is going to be the most exciting part of computing for the next few years. It's just getting started.
Interesting. Yeah, that's kind of, you know, it's... I agree with you. The kind of, you know, we haven't seemed to kind of really integrate it, you know, the kind of, you know, the humans and the computer, right? We can, you know, it's still outside, but you know, often, I mean, why, you know, I mean, like, I broke my leg, I have like all kind of metal pins in there, so we kind of, you know, put stuff in our bodies, so why not kind of, you know, have computers, kind of, you know, smart things, kind of, you know, implanted in our bodies to help us, you know.
Well, that's one aspect of it. Yeah. You know, the robot car doesn't involve implanting anything.
No,
in your
but
body.
But your kind of, you know, the little
the
voice
glasses.
In the glasses are, you know, because you know, why do they your glasses? Why not kind of directly kind of connected to your brains? I don't know. I mean,
well, you might want to wait a few years longer before doing that.
You know, it's like if it blue screens.
Right.
Exactly.
If it's just in the glasses and it's blue screens, I can take the glasses off.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
Not so bad.
Interesting.
Voice, so I think you want to be a little bit if. I have no objections in principle to implants, but I think you want to be a little careful.
Yeah, I think it would be kind of...
You wouldn't have put all that stuff in your leg if you had a reasonable alternative, right?
Well, that's true. At that point, I didn't have a choice. Although,
right.
I think it would be quite cool to have, like, a USB port, you know, like, you know, somewhere.
But, I mean, this brings up an interesting point, because as you mentioned, 60 years has gone by and stuff, and, like, it doesn't seem to me that we're making a lot of progress in AI. I mean,
we've made a huge amount of progress.
But where is it?
The reason that AI is always in a mess, somebody said, it's the same reason that philosophy is always in a mess, which is that whenever anything is successful, it gets spun out and given a different name.
Mm.
So, you know, computer vision got spun out from AI, but it's now enormously successful in a whole range of things. Just to pick one random example, look at photosynth.
Mm. Yeah.
That's no longer considered to be AI at all. It's completely separate. The whole field of computer vision is a completely separate field with its own conferences and so forth. But it grew out of AI.
Interesting.
Speech recognition. I just installed Windows 7 RC on this machine behind me, and I picked up my headset and I dictated three paragraphs, and I think it made one error.
Nice.
That also started out as part of AI in the 1970s. And that's pretty much the way it goes.
I think that's true. And because, like, what is AI means? Artificial intelligence. But once you have figured it out, now it's not artificial anymore, right? Now you know.
Or it's not intelligent anymore.
Yes, or it's not intelligent.
Right.
Yes, yes. So
I think that's the key, right? Because that's like sort of the machine learning stuff, right? You get all this data, you analyze it, you see patterns, and then you can then predict what's going to happen and then act on that. But the notion of intelligence, artificial intelligence, I don't know how far we've gotten in that space. But then again, I'm not the expert here. I'm the ignorant.
Well, it's absolutely true that AI started out with some visions about how computers would be able to
think.
Yeah, right? Think, and since we don't really have any idea what thinking consists of, and so yes, we haven't made any progress in that direction.
Well, I mean, what do you?
But progress in that direction is extremely scary. 12 years ago, the ACM celebrated its 50th anniversary, and they had a conference to cap the celebration. At the conference, they invited 20 or so people to give their predictions about what would happen in computing in the next 50 years. Which I never would have dared to do.
Like, but these programs in twice the size. Yeah.
Right. These guys were fearless. In particular, Nathan Myhrvold, whom I used to work for, was one of the people. And he predicted various things. And he capped off his piece by predicting uploading. So what's uploading, you ask?
Mm-hmm.
You get to scan out your brain and load it into a computer.
Yeah, well,
Why would you want to do that? Well, you could be immortal. That seems appealing.
Interesting.
But it's kind of scary, too.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. We're going to have to approach this slowly.
Yeah. On the other hand, a lot of ways we interact with a computer is very indirect, right? I mean, it goes to your brain, then it goes to your muscles, mm-hmm. and then you have to type it in.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we can together go way back to the beginning of the conversation, if we could short circuit, all those layers of unnecessary abstraction, and I could directly communicate with the computer, I mean, I would take whatever implants necessary for that. I don't know.
Well, it's good to know that some people are going to be fearless. I'll probably wait a little longer. But that's certainly going to be much easier than uploading in any case.
Yes,
absolutely.
Yes. That's
pretty far-fetched.
And of course, other people have picked up this uploading idea, so you can now read all about it, for example, in Ray Kurzweil's book, The Singularity is Near.
Mm. Yeah?
Interesting.
And I think there's also, in some sense, like in small people already do that, maybe not dump your whole brain, but, there are websites where, if you die, you can you can be there forever, and you can buy that. It's like, your cyber grave, And so
this is different from a real physical grave?
Yes. Yeah. And then they keep it, on the web forever. I don't know, you cannot check that, of course, but yeah, so in some sense, this kind of baby steps towards this.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So one thing that we haven't talked about, which is hard to believe, is this whole many-core and parallelism problem that everyone's freaking out about.
Yes.
Some people say it's a bunch of hype, and some people say no, it's a real, it's a hard problem.
A bunch of hype.
Well, some
cores are real.
Well, the thing is that we had a conversation, actually. We won't mention any names because it's not fair to do that. But one of the things we had talked about, what this person has said was, look, 20 years ago, it was the same thing, right? It seems like every 10 or 20 years, we invent these new concurrency parallelism problems. And he thought this is just another one of them.
Yeah, or I can give you an example, right? When I was a student in the 80s, the hype around functional programming, that was going to solve, And now, when I hear the current generation of functional programmers, I hear exactly the same propaganda, so to speak, that I heard 20 years ago.
Well, that I agree with, but multi-core is real.
Yeah.
And we're kind of stuck with it. It seems pretty clear that if we want to use the additional transistors that Moore's Law is giving us for anything other than more cash, you're going to be stuck with multi-core. That's not like functional programming.
Mm. But
we're stuck with it.
Yeah.
We are not stuck with functional programming.
the thing was that functional programming was useful for parallelism to because
it
even
helps.
There they were saying, oh no, we can build these massively parallel machines, and the only way we can program them is using functional programming.
Well, that's certainly not true, but it does help with a lot of things. I mean, look at Link. Link is functional programming, right?
Yeah. But then, so how do you think we should program these, many cores or massively parallel systems?
Well, my slogan for parallel computing is stripe, stream, or struggle.
Okay. Hmm. So stripe is that's, I guess, data parallelism?
Data parallelism of one kind or another.
Okay.
Right? And stream is pipelining or data flow.
Okay.
And if you can't do either one of those things, then you're going to have to struggle.
Yeah.
And the only thing that's practical, I think, is find a wizard, find a part of your problem that encapsulates most of the heavy lifting, get the wizard to code it up, and then call it from the outside in a non-concurrent way.
Yeah.
And those are the only approaches I know of that have actually been demonstrated to work.
Yeah.
And the wizard can do more or less arbitrarily complicated things, but not many of us are wizards.
Yep.
I thought when we invented threads and locks and condition variables at Park in the 70s, we were absolutely convinced that this would be a feasible way of doing concurrent programming, and that most programmers would be able to do it. Well, I think we've now accumulated 35 years of convincing evidence that that's not true. Most programmers cannot program with threads and locks and condition variables. It doesn't work.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, I would say, even if you make it easier, like what we talked about with STM or something, that's still
going to be hard.
Exactly. This is like intrinsically hard.
Well, there's some things that can work. I mean, transactions actually can work. In fact, it has seemed to me that the whole business of transactions as they're manifested in a full-fledged transaction processing monitor, there's nothing like it anywhere else in computing. I think of it as being a sort of pixie dust. Because think about how it works. You hire 500 COBOL programmers to work for your bank or electric company or whatever it is, and each one of them writes a simple sequential program. It's all they know how to do. And then you take these 500 sequential programs and you toss them into the TPM and you sprinkle TPM pixie dust on them. And by magic, now they run concurrently. They run concurrently, they're fault tolerant, they're load balanced, and it's just all done by magic.
Yeah.
There's nothing like it anywhere else in computing.
Yeah. Interesting.
It doesn't solve all the world's problems, but for the things that fit within that story, it's just absolutely extraordinary.
But that's, you know, I used to think like that too, unless, like, I mean, I kind of, you know, started to work in Building 35 at SQL. And there's like, you know, when you look at transactions, there's like all the kind of different isolation levels where people kind of are trying to kind of, you know, to get performance.
Well, those are performance hacks. You don't get to...
And so they kind of, they have the pixie dust, but that's, you know, that's maybe kind of too expensive, all the kind of...
Well, yeah, then it's not as good.
Yeah.
Then it's kind of silver instead of gold pixie dust.
But then, but my feeling is that when you really start to kind of, you know, deal with these isolation levels, now you're... It becomes as hard as using logs and so on.
But then it's not pixie dust anymore.
Yes, exactly.
You shouldn't do that.
Yeah. But to go back to like writing the kind of, you know, operating system kernel in using transactions, I'm not sure that, you know, you can get...
No, I made no such claim.
No, but what I'm saying is like... The
you don't write the operating system kernel in COBOL either.
Yes, but the interesting question is, can you get away doing that with only using the pixie dust, or do you have to kind of go and kind of have performance hacks where you kind of...
For the operating system kernel, there's absolutely no doubt that you can
Have performance
hacks.
So maybe we can already kind of dismiss the idea to write it in Haskell, because, you know, it will be...
I don't think it will
be easier, because, you know, I think that's my gut feeling, is that you will have to kind of go and do some hacking, you know.
There's no doubt that that's going to be the case. The question is the whole job going to be substantially easier, or is the hacking going to be so ugly?
Yeah.
But you know, the whole functional programming thing, in 1980, Jim Morris wrote a wonderful paper called Real Programming in Functional Languages. And the technical content of this paper was to explain that a language that Jim Horning and I and some other people designed in the mid-70s was actually a functional language, which was a big surprise to us, because it never entered into our heads when we were designing it. But the best part of this paper is the introduction. And in the introduction, he says, many people complain about functional programming because they say it's unnatural. This is ridiculous. Functional programming is a discipline, and all disciplines are unnatural. The proper question to ask about a discipline is not whether it's natural, but whether it's effective. But then he says there's still more to it, because there's different kinds of effectiveness. And we can understand this better if we look at two Japanese disciplines, haiku and karate. These actually have quite a few things in common. They've both been around for centuries. They have an elaborate structure of connoisseurship and achievement and ratings and so forth. But there is one important difference. Haiku... To practice haiku successfully, you need an appreciative audience.
Yeah.
If you find yourself in a barroom brawl, karate will work, even if no one else in the bar knows it.
Yes.
So now the question is functional programming more like haiku or more like karate?
I think it's definitely haiku.
And there's no doubt that in 1980 it was haiku. And
yes.
It's still pretty much that way, I think.
Yes. Yes. I should kind of find that paper. It sounds like a good read. So I think, Charles, do you have any kind of questions?
I think it's great. We've taken a lot of your time.
Yes,
we appreciate it.
Okay, well, it was fun.
Absolutely.
I hope you got through all your questions.
I got through all my questions.
Wow.
I had, like, you know, I was looking at this because the kind of many core parallel programming was on here. That was the one that we haven't talked about.
Yeah.
And I'm really looking forward to, you know, seeing the fruits of your synchronization work.
Okay. Well, I hope it'll work out.
Yeah, great. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
You bet.
Take care. Absolutely.